Resuming from chapter 18, canto 1. Very nice section of verses for this morning. Sutta Goswami has just been asked to expand the topics that he's touched upon already, particularly giving more information about what Maharaj Parikshit, the glories of the Supreme Lord as they were heard by Maharaj Parikshit. Of course, this means glorifying Krishna, and this is the essence of all the subject matters of Srimad Bhagavatam, starting from the first canto, even before Shukadeva Goswami starts to speak. Sutta is speaking, and he's speaking about Krishna, and the sages, they want to hear about Krishna. The personality of Godhead, Lord Krishna Govinda, is the exclusive shelter for all great living beings, and his transcendental attributes cannot even be measured by such masters of mystic powers as Lord Shiva and Lord Brahma. Can anyone who is expert in relishing nectar or rasa ever be fully satiated by hearing topics about him? Oh, Sutta Goswami, you are a learned and pure devotee of the Lord because the personality of Godhead is your chief object of service. Therefore, please, and hurry up, describe the pastimes of the Lord, which are above all material conceptions, for we are anxious to receive such messages. This is their qualification and Sutta's qualification. Many times in this first canto, like a refrain, making it very clear, the first canto is enunciating what are the qualifications of this, for this Bhagavat Dharma process? Eagerness. What's the eligibility for the candidate for devotional service? You want it. One is eager for it. How to advance? How to questions? How to? This is the how to. If you can begin properly, you can continue properly. The obstacles that meet us all on the path of devotional service, how to overcome this obstacle, how to... Eagerness for the hearing and chanting process. And you can do all the other how-tos in the world that you like, and it's not going to do anything without the potent form of this hearing, shravanam, kirtanam, done in the proper way. And Sutta is the qualified speaker. He knows the science, not just because he's like smart. He knows the science because he has one object in his life, Krishna. He's Krishna's devotee. Pure in devotion, and because he's attentively heard, he knows the science of how the whole thing works, and therefore he can explain it in that manner. We'll come back to this particular point. Where does understanding the details of the science of Krishna consciousness come into play? Is it not sufficient just to engage in hearing the holy name and just expressions of devotion. I'll mention it, but it comes up again in the upcoming verses. Yes, it is sufficient. The holy name, Krishna, Krishna, the holy name, is fully independent. He doesn't need anything. He doesn't require anything. The process of spiritual perfection, just by chanting the holy name alone, is sufficient. However, we may have misconceptions. Not only we may have misconceptions, we usually do. Invariably we do have misconceptions. And therefore the process of chanting the names of Krishna is combined with sambandha gyan, having proper spiritual conceptions, just basically knowing what's going on, am I going this way or that way? Who is Krishna? Who am I? Basic conceptions, displacing the misconceptions, according to our acharyas in this, like Haridas Thakur, according to the acharyas in the process of hearing and chanting, it's necessary to get the full benefit is beyond liberation. Even if one doesn't understand these things, one can get liberation. And liberation means, just put it in simple terms, all material contamination, restrictions, limitations, modes of nature, karma, all those obstacles, body, mind, past deeds, obstacles, finished. Even if you don't know what's what. You don't have sambandha gyan. But Sutta, as the qualified teacher, instructor, he knows what's what. He's highly learned and he's pure devotee. Highly learned devotee, highly learned in the science of devotion, and pure in his devotion, unmixed in his motives. O Sutta Goswami, please describe those topics of the Lord by which Maharaj Parikshit, whose intelligence was fixed on liberation, attained the lotus feet of the Lord, who is the shelter of Garuda, the king of birds. Those topics were vibrated by the son of Vyas, Shukadev Goswami. So they're milking the cow in their eagerness. They want rasa. They want the topics of Krishna. Thus, please narrate to us the narrations of the unlimited. Now, how can you do that? This is limited. The subject matter is limited. Unlimited. So, sutta, that's one of the first things that sutta addresses. How can a limited instrument speak the unlimited? And one can say, you can't. And that's true. But the limited can be infused with potency of the unlimited and can do. We'll see. These narrations were spoken to Maharaj Parikshit, and they are very dear to the pure devotees, being full of bhakti yoga. So that ends the section. That's text 17. And now we're moving on to the next section, Sutta replies. So the sages, they're, as we say these days, fired up. They're ready, eager, enthusiastic, and they're very clear about what they want. And they're very clear who the qualified person is to speak it. The first thing that Sutta Goswami speaks, want to guess? He speaks words of humility. First thing. He's transparent. Meaning, he takes nothing. It just goes. And so, in his humility, he first describes his disqualification. And first on his list of disqualifications is his low birth. Now, Sutta Goswami is, do we think of Sutta Goswami as low born? He's thinking of himself like that because he is the son, who is he the son of? Romaharshan Sutta. Now Romaharshan Sutta, he was entrusted when Vyas divided the Vedas, and he entrusted different personalities to be in charge of each of the four Vedas, and then he compiled the Puranas, and he trusted that to Romaharshan Sutta. Vyas trusted him, whatever his birth was. But sure enough, later on, Romaharshan Sutta had to be kusagrasthed by Balaram, because although he, by scholarship, by retention of memory, and even by, you know, his qualifications as a speaker, he was a good speaker. His name Romaharshan indicates, as he would speak, his hairs would stand on end. Romaharshan. He was an ecstatic speaker. But he had a disqualification. And his disqualification was, spiritual disqualification, was that he failed to offer respect to the object of the glorifications that he was reciting. When Balaram came into that assembly, when Romaharshan was speaking, he stayed seated, thinking, I'm speaking Srimad Bhagavatam, and so I should stay seated while all the assembled personalities offer their respects to Lord Balaram. But Romaharshan, the purpose of narrating Srimad Bhagavatam was to glorify the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and here he comes. If we respect the Srimad Bhagavatam, do we not respect the Personality of Godhead, or vice versa? If we respect the Personality of Godhead, do we not respect the words glorifying the Personality of Godhead? Is there a difference? Respect one and not the other? I'll do a little side story here and come back. In New York, one time Srila Prabhupada was arriving from the airport, at the airport from some place, and the temple president and our GBC made a plan whereby they wanted to give the devotees the opportunity, and for the pleasure of Srila Prabhupada, to receive him in full force at the airport. But they also wanted devotees to receive Prabhupada at the temple, when he got to the temple. So rather than sending some to the airport and leaving some at the temple, the plan was everyone would go to the airport, and the driver that was driving Prabhupada would take a longer route. And so they would get there at the temple after everyone got back to the temple. That was the plan. So everyone went to the airport, received Prabhupada. It was a wonderful reception. And as Yogamaya would have it, the plan of the temple president didn't work out that way. Prabhupada got there very swiftly, and everyone else got lost. Not lost, but, you know, took some turns and got there after Prabhupada got there. So when Prabhupada arrived at Radha Govinda's temple, all that was there in the temple was the pujari, and it was the noon arati, and the pujari was on the altar, and Prabhupada came into the temple room while they were ringing the bell and performing the arati. And that particular altar, there was just like a marble step up, and then the altar where the devotee would stand, you know, just from the floor, a little step up, and then, you know, the tiers of marble altar for the deities. And so, it was, the person was Rukmini, Nuttama's wife. So she's ringing the bell and offering the articles, and in comes Srila Prabhupada. So she's worshipping Radha Govinda, and here comes her spiritual master. What to do? She put down the bell and put down the article and got off the altar and paid her obeisances when Prabhupada came in. Got back up on the altar, resumed the arati. And she asked Prabhupada afterwards, was that proper? And his answer was, it was proper. Now normally that's not proper. There's in fact, in Nectar of Devotion, there's injunction not to worship anyone else before the personality of Godhead. Like when we, you know, put what do you call it? Call the curtain.
Screen.
Screen. We put up the screen because when we perform Tulsi Puja, because we don't worship before the Lord. That's in Nectar Devotion. That's scriptural injunction. In Srila Prabhupada's case, he made an exception as the Acharya in order to teach his low-born, Western, uncivilized, uncultured, untrained, crazy followers that the principle of worshipping the spiritual master is extremely important. So he even allowed, after greeting the deities, that he would sit under the Vyasasan, and we would worship him in Guru Puja before the deities, which is against what it says in Nectar Devotion, because the principle was so important. So this particular example of worshipping the spiritual master or the pujari coming off the altar, my understanding is, as with Guru Puja, that is specifically appropriate for Srila Prabhupada and not the same for others. At least that's my understanding. But, in other words, the pujari from within their heart, that worship can be there, that offering of respect can be there. And in the case of Balaram, the Supreme Personality of God, and that's not a devotee of the Lord, it's the Lord. And he is to be worshipped immediately. One comes into the presence of the deity immediately, or one comes into the presence of the Lord immediately, or one comes into the presence of Srimad Bhagavatam. It's our literary incarnation of the Supreme Lord. We offer our respects in a formal way. Ramaharshan Sutta didn't do that. And so he lost his life. And then immediately thereafter there was some discussion about the background of Ramaharshan Sutta. The background of Ramaharshan Sutta was, and I don't know the exact details, but he was from a Pratiloma birth. There's these two kinds, Anuloma and Pratiloma. Anuloma is where the father is from a higher caste, and the wife is either of the same caste or of a lesser caste, and there's different names for those different things. The Brahmin who marries a Brahmini, the Brahmin who marries a Kshatriya, the Brahmin who marries Vaishya and Shudra, and there's names for each. And that's fine, it's Anuloma. It's Vedic, standard. Fine. Pratiloma is reverse. The wife is Brahmana and she marries Kshatriya. And the son that is born of that marriage is the Pratiloma. And that was the type, specifically the type of marriage from which Ramaharshi and Sutta was born. Now Vyas, who's the compiler of the Vedas, who perfectly knows all these, you know, all the rules, he honored Ramaharshi and Sutta. For him it didn't make any difference because he had the suitable training and qualification, and so he not only was respected as a Brahmana, but he was entrusted with the knowledge of the Puranas, or maintaining the Puranic literature, included in which is Srimad Bhagavatam. So that's what Sutta is referring to here when he says, O Supreme Lord. So he's been addressed by the sages, but now he's addressing God. O God, although we are born in a mixed caste, not only mixed caste, but specifically Pratiloma mixed caste, and therefore he's considering himself lowborn, or there's something inauspicious in my birth. Despite this, we are still promoted in birthright simply by serving and following the great, who are advanced in knowledge. So this is a principle that's a very significant principle, Bhagavat Dharma principle. What to speak of in our contemporary situation? Right in the pages of the scripture itself, the person who's the speaker, right after Shukadeva Goswami is Suta Goswami, who is in this by birth, not auspicious birth. So that's thousands of years ago. Prabhupada's comment is, this whole the idea of extreme emphasis upon birth only is a more, it's not like altogether new, but the degree of emphasis of it is modern, within the last 100 years or so. Now, 150 years. There's always been bodily identification, and my body's better than your body because that's not a new one. And so my body's better than your body based upon the family in which I was born, that's also not uncommon. But that by birth only, one is eligible for so many things. And conversely, if one is not born in that same higher, more auspicious circumstance, then there's only one alternative, and that is due to that lower birth is due to some past sinful activities. So you perform your duties according to that birth in order to pay your dues for those past sinful activities. And don't do any more sinful activities. Yesham tundakatam papam. And engage in your proper duties. But this is, there's a higher principle. And the higher principle is immediately invoked through the Bhagavad Dharma principle. The Bhagavad Dharma principle is stated right here. It's association with qualified people through the process of hearing and chanting transcendental topics. I'd like to emphasize this in some particular way, and maybe I'll just say it simply and directly. This is a principle upon which the Srimad Bhagavatam rests. That, the visits that I've made here before, I've spoken about the sixth canto from beginning to end. It's a long canto, same 19 chapters. And the title of the whole canto is Prescribed Duties for Mankind, and one of the themes of the canto is there are Karmakanda, Gyanakanda, and the higher order of Bhagavad Dharma principles by which Dharma can be evaluated. And this Bhagavad Dharma principle eclipses altogether the progressive birth after birth after birth stages of elevation, if one could possibly properly do them in this age. Footnote, you can't because there aren't qualified brahmanas to conduct all of those rituals in their actual intended purpose. Things like lighting fire by mantras or bringing animals to the sacrificial fire, they enter, they come back in a young form. I mean, the brahmanas are not qualified in such ways, and so many other examples. So, that is to say, the Bhagavad Dharma process is the only remaining process, and it's very quick and swift and very effective. And for this age, you need something that's very quick. People don't have to have this incredible capacity. They can be unqualified, but they're made qualified. Capacity is expected to come. It's not that we just remain Kali Yuga personalities and do anything, say anything, eat anything, speak anything, and conduct yourself however, just hear and chant and it's okay. That's not correct. But rather, those real qualifications become decorations of one who properly takes up this process. The disqualifications are removed and the proper qualifications are brought, and they're resting upon the hearing and chanting process. I'll say it again. Say the same thing in another way. Those who are engaged in the hearing and chanting process are expected. We who are engaged in the hearing and chanting process are expected to develop real qualities based upon the hearing and chanting process that qualifies us to receive the decoration of those qualities. And we should, like the sages, be eager for the topics, but also be eager for the qualities and qualifications to live the life of this message by the qualities that we conduct our activities by. The process delivers it. As the other process, after lifetimes and lifetimes and lifetimes and lifetimes, also has the capacity to deliver high qualifications. We are meant to, although presently we're victims, I guess, we're part of the Kali Yuga process. Kali Yuga, like, blah. We're meant to develop, to receive the removal of those disqualifications and the establishment of the proper qualifications, and the string, the thread upon which the whole thing hangs is our qualifications as eager hearers and the qualifications of the proper speaker and the relationship. And then everything is meant to manifest itself. So Sutta speaks first about that he is being held up on this pedestal as Kamadhenu. And he's saying, I don't have that qualification. In fact, I have disqualification. Look at the birth from which I have come. And this killing of the decease of Rama Maharshi and Sutta took place before the same sages that are speaking to Sutta Goswami. They know what the history is. They know the disqualification. So it's not secret that he's disclosing. But what he's speaking is the voice of humility. He's not thinking, yes, I am all these things. Fine. Now I understand that you're an intelligent audience. You know all of my qualifications. The opposite. His position is that of a transparent, humble personality. I don't have qualifications. If there's some qualifications, it's the process. The merciful Shukadeva Goswami, the merciful process. And because of that process, my disqualifications have been removed. Which means the message for us is, whatever obstacles, whatever all those, how do I overcome this and that kind of things, it's taken care of by the process of hearing and chanting. Regularly performed in the proper manner, with the proper regard from the proper speaker. Although we are born in a mixed caste, we are still promoted in birthright . So, the circumstance changes simply by serving, not just hearing, serving and following the great who are advanced in knowledge. Even by conversing with such great souls, one can without delay cleanse oneself of all disqualifications resulting from lower births. And that statement, lower births, you can put under it like little subsets of other things, or just focus on those other things. Bad misdeeds in the past result in low birth. Bad association, mixture with the modes of nature, impure desires, whatever, just all the subsets. And it's just kind of categorized under one thing. So you could break it down and say all those things. Or just say it in one thing. Or even one of the other things. Whatever are the inventory list of disqualifications. I mean, you can't find someone in this age of Kali that has only good qualifications and no disqualifiers. Doesn't exist. This is the age of Kali. Everything's contaminated, starting with consciousness. And then, it goes down into the gross elements, the air, the water, and everything's contaminated. Because consciousness is contaminated. But, the force of what he's speaking is through the voice of humility, he's expressing that the process of Bhagavad Dharma has taken him from the position of disqualification to being able to address what has been asked. The next coming up is the thing that you've asked me to address is the glorification of the unlimited. Ha! Who can do that? An individual can't do that, except if they're empowered by the potencies of the unlimited. So it's the same statement in another application. Just to be in a position where Sutta is saying, where I'm speaking before you, I don't have the qualification except this descending mercy principle. And the task that you've asked me, I can't do that either, except through the descending mercy principle. Historically, it's not here in this purport, but I just like to make the emphasis. This is 5,000 years ago. Historically, the great acharyas of the four sampradayas, they also followed this principle that not regarding birth, but regarding the spiritual qualification of the individual, they were placed in a position of performing brahminical work. Because of their Vaishnav, their devotee of the Lord qualification, given services that were of brahminical qualification. Here's Vyas doing the same. The sages doing the same. Our great acharya is doing the same. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu explicitly doing the same. The process of chanting the holy name is the process, the Yuga Dharma, and born in a Muslim family, Haridas Thakur. Now, like Sutta, Haridas Thakur was thinking, I'm low-born, disqualified, or high-born. Sanatana and Rupa Goswami were born in high-class Saraswat Brahmin families. But they had become contaminated, or apparently so, by their taking up service in the government of a Muslim king and doing the bidding of such a person. That's forbidden for a Brahmin. They did it. They did it for reasons of just saving the lives of the Vaishnavas, and that they were put in that compromised position by the nasty Nawab Hussein Shah. But nonetheless, they did that, so they lost their caste. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu placed them in an exalted position, regardless of birth or the loss of birthright. And Srila Prabhupada, Bhaktisiddhanta, all the great acharyas, they've done the same. The persons who are very much attached to the bodily conception of life and projecting or reading from the Vedas that bodily conception of life had, they took big issue with those personalities, including great acharyas, for applying this principle that's right here in this verse in practical ways. The real qualification is the qualities of hearing, the qualities that one becomes decorated with by hearing and chanting. In other words, specifically, Prabhupada gave brahminical initiation to persons who came from Mlecha Yavana families. And those that were born brahmanas, they had a big issue with that. And they came and verbally, vigorously lodged complaint to Srila Prabhupada. And not just on one occasion. Privately and publicly. What's an acharya to do? You know, he's got to do what the scripture says. And what predecessor acharyas have done. And the dislike of that came as it did with the other personalities who did like that. It doesn't make the principle, we don't evaluate the accuracy of the principle based on public opinion. It's what Scripture says. So, such is the power of pure devotees of the Lord. The Ganges water is accepted as pure, and one can become purified after taking a bath in the water of the Ganges. But as far as great devotees of the Lord are concerned, they can purify a degraded soul even by being seen by the lowborn. And what to speak of association? Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu wanted to purify the whole atmosphere of the polluted world by sending qualified preachers all over the world. Here's a little plug for those of you that have taken your birth in India. And it remains with the Indians to take up this task scientifically and thus do the best kind of humanitarian work. Now, Prabhupada is saying that, as you undoubtedly know, it's a quote from Chaitanya Charitamrita. Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami has attributed this statement to Lord Chaitanya, that those who have taken birth in this auspicious land, that is, the impressions, the former piety that entitles one to be born in a place where, from the very outset, the sound of Krishna's name is heard. I didn't have that opportunity till after 20 years of my life. I heard lots of other sounds, but not that sound. So, those who are fortunate to have those impressions, that asset is an asset that they should use. And it's an order of Lord Chaitanya. With that order comes great force, great strength, great power, great responsibility. Right after making that statement about persons born in India have this birthright responsibility to make their life an offering of upliftment to all of humanity in the world, the very next thing that Prabhupada says, the mental diseases of the present generation are more acute than bodily diseases. The sufferings that humanitarian work requires is more than bodily benefits, opening hospitals, and those kinds of things. The mental distresses and diseases, and it doesn't mean then just opening psychiatric hospitals. It means the spiritual welfare. Because when there's spiritual welfare, material well-being follows spiritual well-being. Like a shadow follows the object that moves, casting the shadow. Why are there these both physical and mental distresses? Because of things are so out of place on a spiritual level. So that's the statement that Prabhupada is making here. Therefore, it is quite fit and proper to take up the preaching of Srimad Bhagavatam all over the world. We just covered one verse. Sutta's just getting started. And what to speak of those who are under the direction of the great devotees chanting the holy name of the unlimited, who has unlimited potency, the personality of Godhead, unlimited in potency and transcendental in attributes, is called Ananta. So, I was just hearing one lecture given in Mayapur. No, excuse me, it was given in Los Angeles, where Prabhupada was introducing to a new audience, Krishna consciousness movement. And he started in a very unusual way. He said, there are many people who say that God is so great, you cannot utter his name. A small person cannot utter the name of the Supreme Great. And Prabhupada said, and it's true. But he has so many names, because those so many names indicate his qualities. And within the vibration of those names that indicate his qualities or his relationships with others, what he does in relation to his devotees when he comes into this world, all spiritual potency of the Supreme Lord are there within those names. And he gave many examples of names and names and names. He was just, you know, enchanting the audience to hear names. And by hearing these names, our dormant consciousness of God becomes awakened on the level of personal realization, just by hearing his names. And then attraction to him, serving him, and perfection of life will come. This is our Krishna consciousness movement. So please come and take part. It was very sweet. There are other things he expressed too, but how does one utter the holy name? Or what Sutta is being asked, how do you describe the unlimited? How do you describe the activities of the unlimited? Because he's unlimited. In other words, this idea of the impersonalist, as soon as you say form, you've just limited the unlimited. In their estimation, formless, that's unlimited. Form, you've just limited the unlimited. Name, he who has no name, you just limited. And so forth. That's an impersonal conception, but the scriptures teach us that the Brahman is that aspect of Brahman is resting upon, or its pratishtha is the personal feature of the Lord. The personal feature of the Lord is also unlimited, or not exactly more unlimited, but within the personal feature, the impersonal feature is contained, and not vice versa. So Sutta is going to disclose, by the agency of this descending mercy, the activities of the unlimited. So that's where the emphasis is going. Again, the descending process that makes this otherwise impossible task manifest by descending mercy. So the Supreme Lord, he has unlimited potencies, and so he can manifest. But he can also manifest those potencies in someone limited. And someone limited can do something that's unlimited. Follow? So the simple example that Prabhupada has given us, well, it's several. The iron rod in the fire becomes like fire. The copper wire becomes like electricity, although it's just copper wire. The ordinary can become extraordinary, beyond ordinary, by the investing of special powers from the extraordinary. That's this descending process. Sutta is saying, because of associating with Shukadeva Goswami, I don't have any qualification, I have disqualification. But I can perform the service that you're asking on the strength of this descending mercy. So he's just like, you know, clearing up for the record, I can't do what you've asked, but I'll be an instrument for what you've asked. Sukadeva Goswami can speak through me, Since Krishna's name and he himself are identical, the holy name of the Lord can protect the devotee from all effects of sins. The chanting of the holy name of the Lord can undoubtedly deliver one from the disadvantages of a lower caste birth and any other disqualifications. A wicked mind, lusty desires, whatever it is. Attraction for the impermanent, whatever it is. The holy name can deliver one from that condition. The Lord's unlimited power is extended on and on by the unlimited expansions of the devotees and incarnation. Doesn't that make sense? The unlimited, not only unlimited can upgrade the limited, but it's part of his way of expanding himself or his expanding his glories. Those limited then glorify the unlimited, and the expansion of the glories are expanded. Makes sense to me. And if we say no, then all that we've managed to do is philosophically put God out of existence. But you can't philosophically put God out of existence just by saying no. The naysayers can go on naysaying, and the Supreme Lord goes on expanding his unlimited potencies. Since the devotee, thus every devotee of the Lord and incarnations also can be equally surcharged with the potency of the Lord. Since the devotee is surcharged with the potency of the Lord, even fractionally, the disqualification due to lower birth, etc., cannot stand in the way. Now, there is an exception if there's offense, or there's one turns one's attention away. In the case of Rama Maharshi and Sutta, it was an offense. In the case of any one of us, it can be the same, an offense. Or it can be just slackening in submission. I was struggling, or I had curiosity. Now, by contact with the holy name and the scripture and the deity form and the process of devotional service and the devotees, now that suffering is mitigated and my curiosity is satisfied. The things that I felt that were initially impelling me, they're taken care of. And so submission slackens. And when submission slackens, the bottom falls out. There goes the person. Because the uplifting quality is one's eagerness. Back to the first statement from our previous discussions. And when the motivation for eagerness is something material, and the material is satisfied, there goes the eagerness. There goes the submission. And there goes the person. Back into the material energy. So these two, offense or slackening in submission. Again, the material energy covers. It's not that whatever spiritual attainment that one had reached was false, or that it's ever lost. It's true, and it's never lost. But it may just, not be visible for some time. Dormant, but not being exhibited. Like a spark that goes some distance from the fire, it lands on the land, and the intense glowing that was previously fiery becomes just a red ember that's glowing, and if not attended to in course of time, will just become a piece of carbon. But take that piece of carbon or the glowing ember and put it back into the fire, it becomes fiery again because the capacity is there. But the capacity requires proper association. Association through the hearing and chanting process with proper regard for the process and the persons who are engaging one in that process. And the subject matter. And due to offenses, it may take some time for that to reawaken if one has gone away, gone astray. Last verse, because of this, are there classes this morning? No. Okay. It is now ascertained, Sutta is declaring, that he, the personality of Godhead, is unlimited, and there is none equal to him. Consequently, no one can speak of him adequately. You've asked me to speak? Sorry. I'm limited. Great demigods cannot obtain the favor of the goddess of fortune, even by prayers. But this very goddess of fortune renders service unto the Lord, although he is unwilling to have such service. Now, he accepts the service, but it's not the idea is. Krishna is the independent personality, as explained in the purport. Garbhadakshay Vishnu is being worshipped by the goddess of fortune. He doesn't call upon the goddess of fortune. It's time for creation. Can you cooperate with me so we can, do the creation? He, from his navel, he generates a lotus. Independent of the goddess of fortune, Brahma appears. And even Brahma, he empowers Brahma to create entities without the male-female program. He just gets that power from Garbhadakshay Vishnu. So, while the demigods are approaching the goddess of fortune for things that are on their inventory list, and the goddess of fortune is serving the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he isn't dependent upon any of these other beings. They're his direct personal energies, or they're manifesting his vibhutis, his opulences, reflections of his spiritual opulences in this world in just a tiny, fragmental way. He doesn't need anything. He's unlimited, and he's fully independent. And so, How to qualify oneself to speak of that independent person? You have to be very dependent and receive that special mercy. Then it's possible. Only is it then possible. Prabhupada concludes that he has nothing to do does not mean that he is impersonal. We have things to do for a number of reasons. We have all these desires. We want to see our desires fulfilled. Just try to, sit there and have your desires fulfilled. Close your eyes. We have things to do because we have desires. From a religious point of view, we have things to do because we're obliged to purify ourselves. We have duties. Because without those duties, no purification. But Krishna has no, it's a contradiction of terms. He has no independent desires. He has no worldly desires. Because he has nothing to do. He doesn't have religious duty to perform. He has no obligation. And yet he still does things. He explains this in Bhagavad Gita. He does to reciprocate with his devotees. He does to provide the living entities who desire independently from him the opportunity for purification. But he doesn't have to do any of that. Whatever he does, it's out of his kindness and mercy and his love and compassion. His qualities bring forth the things that he does. He is transcendentally so full of inconceivable potencies that simply by his willing everything is done without physical or personal endeavor. Krishna can lift Govardhan Hill without lifting the little finger of his left hand. He can just will it to happen, and there goes Govardhan Hill. But he lifts Govardhan Hill to show, see this, you know, not just my, that's lift the Govardhan Hill, but not even with my right hand, but with my left hand. And not only with my left hand, with just one finger. And just one finger, the little finger. Up goes the mountain. Wow, Krishna, you're great. I've been discussing the ninth chapter, Bhishma Dev chapter. Prabhupada explains that in the battle between Krishna, well, between Bhishma Dev pursuing Arjuna having taken the vow to Duryodhana, that today I will kill Arjuna, or Krishna will break his promise. Now this is Bhishma, you know, strong vow. And Bhishma takes a vow to break the vow of the Supreme Lord. And he's a devotee. What's going on? And if he doesn't, I'll kill his best friend. Right before him. But Krishna is the upholder of the vow of his devotees. Bhishma wanted to show. It's just, you know, anyway, I can get very excited about these pastimes, but Bhishma wanted to show, just see the nature of Krishna, he'll place the vow of his devotee before his own vow. He'll place the protection of his own devotee before his own word. Arjuna, just see the nature of Krishna. I mean, you like this Damodar Leela where, you know, Krishna submits himself to the rope of Mother Jasoda. Watch this one. I'll take a vow that Krishna will break his vow. And Krishna will break his vow. And when Krishna broke his vow, Bhishma was in ecstasy. It wasn't like, aha, I broke his vow. It was just see Krishna. And to break his vow, it was in this mood of chivalry. Krishna came charging after Bhishma. I mean, not just broke his vow. He came charging after Krishna like a lion attacking an elephant. Big elephant. Here comes, you gotta, really, the lion's gotta jump with great force upon the elephant. You know the story, right? Because Bhishma was aiming his arrow at Arjuna. So many arrows Krishna had already, he had moved his body this way and that way to accept the arrows of Bhishma to protect Arjuna from behind. In Brihad Bhagavatamrita, Arjuna talks about this with great moroseness. You say, Narada, you say that how great you are, that Krishna has so much love for you, that he would personally stand between you and the firer of arrows to receive those arrows. And this is my greatness? Do you know how I feel about that? Krishna is my worshipable Lord. I want to take the arrows, not him. I want to serve him. And he's in front, taking the arrows. Huh. How horrible. How. You want to glorify me. What kind of a servant? What kind of devotee am I? But, of course, that's the humility of Arjuna. Krishna liked it. Krishna liked protecting Arjuna, and Krishna liked receiving the arrows of Bhishma. Krishna did it because Krishna liked it. And he had Arjuna on one side and his pure devotee Bhishma on the other side. It was Krishna's pleasure. And when the arrow was aimed, the deadly arrow was aimed at Arjuna, Krishna knew there's only one thing that can stop this from happening, and that's me. So he got down from the chariot, took the wheel of Arjuna, he has a Sudarshan chakra. He doesn't need to, he can just will Bhishma out of existence. But to satisfy Grandfather Bhishma. And did it satisfy Grandfather Bhishma. He got down from the chariot, grabbed the wheel, and started rushing at him like a lion. He was rushing so fast that his outer garment was falling off and he was not even noticing it. Arjuna saw Krishna racing at Grandfather Bhishma. Arjuna grabbed him around the shoulders, around the waist. Supreme Personality of Godhead, right? Being checked by Arjuna. Forget it. The lion chasing the elephant. And Bhishma is just fixed upon the face of the Lord with his hair ashen by the dust raised by the hooves of the horses on the battlefield. And beads of perspiration coming down his face. His eyes copper red. In his intensity of emotion to check Grandfather Bhishma. Raising the chariot ready to smash Bhishma. Bhishma drops his weapons. And seeing the glitter, because it's just at sunset, so seeing the glittering, the reflection of the rays of the sun upon Krishna's dome. I mean, he's got it down, all the details. He's like an artist. The blood stains on the body of Krishna from his own arrows. Krishna smash. Haribol. The end of the day, the sun has set. Fighting is over. Krishna drops the chariot wheel. So these are the narrations that Sukadeva Goswami heard from Maharaj Parikshit, which some of this particular one Sutta has already described. To the sages. And these, just hearing these, the names of Krishna, the pastimes of Krishna, the qualities of Krishna, the form of Krishna, it stirs our transcendental consciousness. And all impure things get washed away. And if one is hearing in the proper manner, all the good qualities will manifest. If the attraction for, attachment for, great feelings for, and love for Krishna awaken, which are intended by this hearing process, then all the good qualifications of the soul will be manifest from the level of the soul, not just the level of the mind. Okay, now you have to be humble. If somebody says something insulting, I'm supposed to not get angry back. Okay, I've got to fasten my mind down like that. I've got to be respectful. Okay, I've got to be respectful. So, not just from the mind, but from the soul, where it's irrevocable. It doesn't come and go. Put it on, take it off, like a set of clothing. Qualities that are from the soul. come from this hearing and chanting process. Disqualifications become overcome. They're just removed. Sutta's glorifying the process that he's being asked to participate in. And next we're going to hear, well, a little bit here, it's even seeing such persons, what to speak of hearing such persons, what to speak of serving such persons. These qualifications happen. It's how the process, we're getting, like, you know, the anatomy of the process of Bhagavad Bhakti through the words of one who has been there, Sutta. And we are meant by that hearing to go there too. To become qualified first by the ardent hearing process, then in turn, in service, to speak those same messages with transparency, not only you repeat the words, but with the heart that's free from any self-intended purpose. Just representing the previous acharyas and speaking that message in a pure and transparent way, not thinking, because I have this qualification, I can speak so nicely. That's the buzzer starts to sound and the red light starts to flash. Wah, wah, wah. That's a disqualifier. The qualification is understanding. The qualification is descending mercy only. Sutta's got that qualification. And he understands the daunting nature of the task. And he understands that he alone can't do it. But he also understands by this descending mercy process, carefully taken up in the right consciousness, Krishna can empower that to happen. That's Krishna consciousness. That's the message that we're hearing in these verses in the 18th chapter. Okay, so I've gone over time. Let's see if there's any questions or discussion on this.
Start speaking in the beginning.
Yeah.
Right after the questions were raised.
The first chapter. Yeah, second chapter.
He glorifies Sukadeva Goswami, but he doesn't speak in the same manner. Not to say that he's not humble there. There's a different mood there than here.
It's just, you know, you can't say everything all the time. He's let me offer my respectful obeisances unto it. So it's just, initially it's just respect. And that's, within that respect is everything else. It's fundamental. Now here it's more detail. Thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada Ki.